Good morning and welcome to this month's Hancock Horizon Investments Economic Update Call. Hancock Horizon Investments provides this call as a monthly economic update for general informational purposes only. Information provided during the call is not intended to be investment advice. Opinions are those of the speakers and not necessarily those of Hancock Holding Company or its affiliates. If you have any questions, you can email them to david.lundgren@hancockbank.com and he'll take them at the end of the call. So on today's call, we have Chief Investment Officer John Portwood, and Investment Directors Greg Hudleski, David Lundgren, Jeffrey Tangus, and Richard Chauvin. With that, I'll pass the call on to David Lundgren, who will be the moderator.
Great. Thank you, Ashley, and good morning, everyone. Welcome to this month's edition of our monthly economic update call. Before we get started, I wanted to introduce and welcome the newest member of our team. Richard Chauvin joined us about 3 weeks ago as an investment director. Richard is a chartered financial analyst. Has been in the asset management business for 30-plus years, so a real veteran of our industry. And formerly, he was chief investment officer for Capital One for 10 years plus. So this is Richard's first call. Welcome to the call, Richard.
I'm excited to be here. Thank you, Dave.
Great. All right, let's get started. And John, first quarter just ended, and you know, I guess so far from early indications, it's going to be an okay quarter. Maybe give us your expectations for economic growth, GDP, and then talk a little bit about your second quarter outlook.
Okay, Dave. It looks like we're back into the pattern similar to what we've seen the last few years, where the first quarter ends up being a little bit slower than usual. At least, you know, let's hope that it is like the pattern of the last few years, because you usually have seen some pickups in the quarters to come after a poor first quarter. And some people argue that that might have to do with the way the data is being calculated these days, but we might have something a little bit different going on this time. The fourth quarter of last year initially looked like maybe something less than 1% based on some numbers that came from a number of the coincident indicator calculators. It turned out to be about a 1.5% quarter, I think 1.48. By the time all the data came in, as of the third estimate, this quarter has been relatively weak as well. The last coincident indicator guess that we had from the Atlanta Fed was 0.7% for the quarter, which is roughly where they were at the end of the fourth quarter last year, the one that was revised up to a little more than one. So it looks okay. It's not really terrible in the sense that we appear to be, you know, trending at a 1.5 to 2%. Annualized rate, I guess, and have been ever since the crash. But you know, certainly it's a bit disconcerting since we're not getting a great deal of improvement after a number of years of central bank activity to try to make things a little bit better. The situation doesn't look any better either from the standpoint of employment. We've talked about this a lot in recent years, the fact that the employment numbers look pretty good, but when you break the employment numbers down, you find that many of the jobs being created in some months, most of the jobs being created have been low-wage jobs and jobs that are likely the result of part-time employment or perhaps workers working two jobs. You may not know this, that are counted as two. If you have more than one job and you work at the fast food place one day and you work at Home Depot the next day, that's counted as two separate jobs being created. So there's been some of that going on. And it's beginning to be written up about in a lot of the media now, more so than it was a few years ago, because I guess it's becoming more obvious than it was then. But one of the recent statistics that's kind of interesting that points out something really different, you know, is and has been happening on the job front, is that withholding taxes, according to one moving average calculation adjusted for inflation, have been declining relative to what was the case a year ago, ever since December. So obviously withholding taxes are based on people that are actually working and sending money into the government. So that indicates that the job market has been relatively soft. The other unfortunate thing that's happened since our last call is that the leading economic indicators are weaker than they were 30 days ago. How much weaker? Well, in some cases, they're weak enough to suggest that there is a more, I guess, material or higher probability of a recession or something like a recession in the not too distant future. Now, the warning flags are yellow. They're not red at this point. You can't really look at it and say, oh, my goodness, you know, we're about to roll over into a recession. You know, also, if we do have something that looks like recession, I guess, at some time in the future, considering that we're only tracking at a 1.5% to 2% growth rate trend, recessions under those conditions may not resemble recessions that we've had in the past, where you see a lot of unemployment and a lot of businesses closing and so forth and so on. You just hit a patch of very, very slow growth that appears to be quite unusual and, I guess, sort of on the edge. And along those lines, for the last few years, we've seen a lot of coincident indicators that they're not really leading indicators. They're more coincident than anything else, that are hovering on the edge of a recession call based on what has been the case since World War II, the way they have looked. And we haven't had a recession. So again, that just gets back to this low trend growth, low probability, I guess, of growth going forward situation that we're in. And it looks like we're still there, and it looks like we're probably not likely to have that change anytime soon.
John, when we met last month, I'm pretty sure it was Super Tuesday, and we said that we were going to reserve any election talk to next month, meaning this month, where we thought we'd have more clarity on who the candidates would be. And I don't know that we're there yet, but give us your thoughts, because I think it's of great interest to a lot of our listeners on, you know, your thoughts about the upcoming presidential election, as well as both Senate and House of Representatives. And then, I guess more importantly, and I know it's hard to forecast because there's so many different scenarios, but, you know, talk a little bit about potential economic or market impacts.
Well, this is certainly the most fractious political environment we've seen in years, probably one of the most fractious and disturbed and uncertain in history. As we all know, the Republican convention is likely to be contested. I've seen really strange stories about what could come out of that, given the rules, given one particular rule. Someone even brought up the point yesterday that Paul Ryan, not having participated in any of the elections, would have a shot at being nominated under some obscure rule that exists. And I guess both parties have rules like that that can cause rather strange things to happen in conventions that the average person might not think about, that's not familiar with the details of the political process. But in the process of considering all of this, and you consider what the Republicans might have in mind in the sense of some things that Donald Trump has said, and what the Democrats might have in mind in a sense of, what Bernie Sanders has said, and I guess to the extent that Hillary Clinton has perhaps mirrored some of Bernie's comments. And it's that big policies are likely, or at least potentially likely, to come out of this election. And the idea of big policies should probably worry all of us because, as we all know, governments are not always sure about the unintended consequences of the so-called big policies. But policy changes could have an impact on the economy significantly. Unfortunately, whether you're looking at either side of the aisle for policy changes, you don't come away with any really good feelings about what might come out of this. on the one hand, I guess, you know, Donald Trump could be a mercantilist of the past in that he might throw a wrench into international trade agreements and cause some problems from that standpoint. On the other side, you've got big government policies that might involve spending more money and exercising more, even more regulatory control over the economy, which could produce some problems as well. So it's going to be a pretty tricky time, I guess, and probably, you know, leave the markets in a state of turmoil until we get some clarity of what might happen. One thing to think about in terms of these big policies and the fractious nature of politics today, it's all coming from the fact that the 1%, if I can use that term, is getting most of the goodies and have been for a number of years. The 99% want a piece of the action, and they don't really care, really, I guess, how they get it. As long as they get something, even if it might be negative to the general economic outlook. And this is not unusual here. It's happening in Europe. It's probably happening to a degree all over the world. And it all has to do with, you know, the economic reset that's underway with, you know, too little growth. We got too much debt. Demographics are not particularly favorable. We've got a lot of excess industrial capacity. So we're in the middle of some sort of transition from the old status quo to something new that is kind of structural in nature. And along the way, of course, we've got central banks that are sticking their toes in the waters trying to change things, and that may or may not work out, you know, to anyone's advantage. And the same thing is happening in politics. So it's a very disturbed picture that probably requires a lot more, you know, everybody's attention, I guess, from an investment standpoint and a business standpoint. It's going to be an interesting and exciting period if it already hasn't been.
Very interesting, for sure. And, you know, I guess I won't promise that we'll have more clarity next month on who the candidates will be. It looks like that's going to be not until, at least on the Republican side, not until probably to the convention. So I guess we'll continue to be talking about this topic for at least the remainder of the year. Greg, good morning.
Good morning.
Well, some good news. You know, really, really strong, solid month for the stock market. It's been a while. And very welcomed by us, obviously, and all of our investors and clients, and kind of refreshing to see some positive momentum in the stock market. I'll let you talk about some of the other averages, but the S&P 500 was up 5.9% for the month. And, you know, I was kind of looking back when we were in mid-February, we're down more than 10% on the S&P 500, so it was a very rough and rocky start, and but a really an amazing turnaround to where we actually finished the quarter in slightly positive territory. The S&P 500 was up 1.4%. So why don't you? I have a couple follow-up questions for you. But why don't you kind of dig into some of the statistics for the month and then maybe talk a little bit about the whys and hows and then maybe where we go from here. And then we'll maybe talk about emerging markets and a couple other things after that.
Yeah, it certainly was a bad start. I mean, January and February were almost mirror images of one another in the sense that, you know, we started out the month and then we immediately went into declines, and then towards the end of January, the stock started to kind of rally back a little bit, but then when February hit, we began to sell off again. And, you know, most of the drivers that were, you know, that really caused concern were really the hard landing in China, which is what we were dealing with last year, further devaluation of the Chinese yuan currency, certainly the plummeting price of oil, which negatively affected the high-yield market and, of course, ignited further fears of a U.S. recession, even though, you know, to some degree, you know, we're, as a U.S. economy, we're insulated from a lot of the global slowdown. But, you know, the big risk there was that if our economy did continue to slip and that consumers really began to fear a recession, and they began to pull back on their consumption, which, again, our economy is consumption-based, that, you know, that could push us into a recession. But as you pointed out, finally in March, some stability appeared, and, you know, it appeared the price of oil stabilized. I think perhaps on the news that OPEC and Russia would freeze production at January levels. Still, there was a glut of oil on the global markets, but and it's, you know, wary whether we can trust OPEC or Russia in terms of maintaining those production targets. But at least that seemed to provide some sanity to the stock markets. And all of a sudden, during the month of March, we our stock markets didn't sell off in sympathy with the global markets, which, you know, it just seemed to go round and round and round during January and February. But I think perhaps more importantly, the Fed signaled it would be careful about raising rates and that four increases were unlikely at this point. And I think with those comments, it appeared to have put pressure on the dollar, resulting in a decline of roughly 4%, almost 4%. And that declining dollar, of course, we've talked in the past, the rising dollar makes earnings translations a negative impact, but the declining dollar, I think, also helped U.S. stocks. But just looking at the numbers year-to-date, the best-performing indices were actually the S&P 400 mid-cap. That was up for the first quarter 3.8%. These are in best to worst. S&P 600, which are small cap stocks, were up 2.7%. S&P, which are large cap stocks, was up 1.3% for the quarter. And the Russell 2000, which is a broader index of small cap stocks, was actually a negative 1.5%. And then finally, NASDAQ wrapping up. And I think, you know, this might be reflective of some of the FANG stocks that we saw driving returns last year. It was down minus 2.4. Moving on to some of the sectors, the big stars really were dividend-type paying stocks, the very defensive telecom and utility stocks. Telecom stocks were actually up for the quarter 16.6%. Utility stocks up 15.6%. Consumer staples, which are, you know, your paper goods and things that you do buy routinely, up 5.6. Industrials up 5%. Energy was actually up 4%. Material stocks up 3.6. Technology up 2.6. Discretionary or consumer discretionary is up 1.6%. The S&P again running in at 1.3. And the two worst performing sectors were financials and healthcare, down minus 5.1% and minus 5.5% respectively. So that kind of wraps up the sector breakdown. In terms of emerging markets, yes, we saw some fantastic performance in really not only emerging markets, but just in international markets in general. And just to give you an idea, some of the International S&P Developed Markets Index was up 7.29 for the month. For the emerging markets, they were up 12.5%, so a double-digit gain there. Latin America was up 20.88%, so huge growth there. Asian index was up 11.92. Australian index up 12.13. And so really across the board, mid to high single digit or, double digit returns in the international markets. And I think driving that really was one, again, the weaker dollar, which makes their debt payments more manageable. It's very hard for the emerging market currencies and international currencies to keep up with the dollar. The dollar really just rocketed once the Fed, you know, made public comments about embarking on raising interest rates. And I think also to some degree solidifying of commodity prices also helped drive up the international markets.
Greg, I guess on previous calls we talked about the FANG effect, how in 2015 you just had a handful of stocks that were really driving the market. The first quarter of 2016, was it a better environment for active managers?
Not really, actually. If you look at it historically, active managers versus, again, passive or indexers, really a good portion of the last 10 years has been tough for stock pickers, but the first quarter actually has been one of the worst. If you look at some of the statistics there, only about 20% of large cap value managers beat their benchmark, and only 6% of growth managers managed to best their benchmark. And as you pointed out, those FANG stocks, you had just a handful of stocks that drove that S&P 500 return, in the sense that it was a very narrow, narrow market, which we don't consider to be a healthy thing. Looking at core managers that really have a style that blend both growth and value characteristics, ended up the best out of the group, beating 29% of the managers beating their benchmark. Again, these are stock pickers, active stock pickers. Some attribute this high level, or I should say underperformance by stock pickers, to high levels of correlations among stocks, meaning that stocks are moving in lockstep, making it very difficult for managers to find stocks that can stand out from the pack. On the bright side, the increase in volatility, although it, you know, sometimes turns people's stomachs, that volatility can kind of break that correlation and allow managers to find stocks that are moving a little bit faster than the rest of the group. And actually, last year, small cap managers did quite well, with about 80% of core managers beating their benchmarks. So perhaps we've got a change on the forefront. We hope so. Certainly that, you know, that would benefit us, again, based with using our quantitative style, but also then being active stock pickers ourselves.
Okay. Thank you much.
Sure.
We did get a question that came in, and I'm going to throw this out. I think John has touched on this in the past, and Greg, you might have as well. And, you know, we've talked about this amongst ourselves, and the question really relates to the downturn in oil and gas prices, and in effect, it seems like that would be a real positive for companies. They would have lower transportation costs, lower, you know, expenses in general, which would, you know, drive increases to the bottom line. But we're seeing just the opposite. We're seeing the market performing well when oil goes up, and the market going down when oil goes down. It just seems like there's a bit of a disconnect there. Does somebody want to take a shot at that and explaining it to our listener who asked the question?
Yeah, I think one of the reasons is, I mean, it definitely puts more money in the consumer's pocket, and that's good. But once you have this dramatic decline in oil prices, it begins to impact the industry. It begins to impact the smaller energy exploration companies that are highly leveraged, which causes layoffs, which in the end, a small decline in the price is beneficial from an economic standpoint. But when you start eliminating jobs, you're basically taking consumers out of the overall economy, and that has ripple effects. So, think of it even as an extension. I was talking with one of the other guys that, you know, one of the coffee producers here have lost something like, I can't remember, it was a couple million dollars, because all of the energy firms don't need as large a catering operation to support their workers. So, again, there's a multiplier effect and, contractionary forces that ultimately can kind of hurt the economy, and, again, it bounces back to the consumer retrenches, then, you know, you raise the probability of a recession.
John, do you want to tag on to that?
That certainly explains, what's happening in the U.S. In Europe, it's something else is happening, I suppose. Europe is an importer of oil, so you would think anyone who imports a lot of oil, I mean, they do get some oil from the North Sea, but most of Europe is still an oil importer. You would think that would give them, the consumers, a boost, and because they're no longer paying as much for gas and oil. And I suppose that has been the case, but you can't find it really in the GDP numbers, which still remain relatively tepid. So In the case of Europe, it may be a situation where people are not making a lot of money to begin with, and they're just, if they have any money left over, they're just not spending it. But it's kind of interesting that, you know, you would not see a reaction in Europe where you actually have, you know, they don't produce any oil, they just import it. So, yeah, and then again, it could be that, you know, what Greg was talking about is such a worldwide issue that the indirect effects are having more of an impact than any of us realize.
Thank you, John. While we're talking about oil and gas, we're just going to skip ahead, I guess, and you know, Richard, I guess it's been an interesting month, interesting time, really, the last year and a half for oil prices. But March was the, I guess, where we first, you know, for the first time in several months where we saw a bounce in prices. You know, we started the month out at about $33 a barrel looking at WTI and jumped to over 40. And really, if you go back to the February lows, we're about 35% up off where we were back in mid-February. And, you know, we've started to fade off a little bit here as we've entered April. But give us, you know, some indication on where you think things are headed regarding the price of oil. Are we going back down into the 20s again, or are we starting to see the price really start to firm up around, you know, $40 a barrel or so? Give us your thoughts.
Sure, sure will, Dave. First of all, I'll say that I think the latest move up was a surprise, just like the dramatic downturn was a surprise to the market. Certainly, I think few people anticipated that. The Energy Information Agency, which is a U.S.-based group, it's a government agency, basically has recently reduced their price forecast, and theirs is probably, obviously, no better than anybody else, but they collect lots of data. And they expect a price for North Sea Brent crude this year about $34 and next year about $40. So those are pretty much the consensus expectations. But I'll add that there's a lot of uncertainty around those expectations, just obviously driven by the tremendous volatility we've seen in over the past several months. Just to give you an example of that volatility, you know, the futures market for energy is huge. Lots of hedgers and speculators use that market. The oil companies themselves use it heavily. You can get an idea of the uncertainty in the market from looking at the futures market. For example, the June delivery prices of West Texas Intermediate crude show a volatility level reflective of a range of prices between $24 and $58. Pretty wide range for only a few months in the future.
Yeah.
Looking out to December, the futures market implies a volatility level between $21 and $81. Giant, you know, just tremendous volatility. Lots of uncertainty about that beyond what you typically see in the futures market behavior. And frankly, there's a good case you can make for both oil prices remaining fairly low as they are now, and there's a pretty good case you can make for a rising oil price later this year and the next year. I'm just going to briefly describe those cases. First of all, the low price case kind of hinges on a couple of things. One of them is the fact that Iran's production is expected by Iran's own boasting that they can put another 500,000 barrels into the market almost immediately. That's probably not true, but there are those who take that seriously, and the market, you know, certainly looks at that and has to take it into account. The other factor is the fact that U.S. producers, many shale producers, for example, have a category of wells called drill but uncompleted, and with very little work or very little future investment, these wells could be turned on and produce a lot of oil relatively fast. There's an inventory of these wells of about 4 to 5 months of activity. And so it's a matter of how quickly the oil companies decide to turn these on, to have them pumping oil, and that will be depend on the fact that whether they see strength in the price. So one scenario might be that oil prices begin to creep up, and they say, you know what, we can make a little bit of money out of this. Let's turn these wells on. And then they turn on the spigots and oil prices again to go right back down again. So there potentially could be a ceiling there. The higher price oil case is a little bit, is fairly strong too, in that, again, Iran probably can't increase production that quickly. They don't have the capital. They've got infrastructure to repair. They don't have necessarily have the expertise or technology in place to do it immediately. Another aspect of the fact that is the fact that there's a natural decline rate in shale production that's very dramatic. Just to give you an example of that, a typical shale well drops production rate from its initial turn period of being turned on. Within the first year, it loses 75% of production. Over 4 years, it produces 90% less than the first year. So you factor that in, and there's a lot of production that's been out there for a while. There's a natural decline rate that may not have been fully taken into account, but it seems to be beginning to decline in the U.S. recently. That could tighten supply and create a better balance. The other thing is there's a number of countries overseas, such as Nairobi and Venezuela, for example, Brazil, that may not be able to produce at the growth rate that they expect because of internal turmoil. So that could tighten supply. But overall, I just want to make the case that there's so many variables to consider here that no one can confidently predict oil prices even 6 months out. But I think the case for a little bit stronger price is maybe a little bit better case, but there's a lot of uncertainty. So I'll leave it at that.
Okay. Well, thank you, Richard. Jeff Dangus, how are you?
Doing great, Dave.
I guess in the month of March, the Fed met, and as always, lots of comments interpreted by both stock and bond markets. And I guess, you know, in my mind, the most interesting takeaway is that it sounds like, you know, there's, you know, still the possibility for a couple rate increases for the remainder of 2016. So if you could maybe touch on your thoughts regarding that, and then also talk a little bit. It wasn't all that dramatic of a move of interest rates during the month. The 10-year basically started at 174, ended at 177. Nothing, you know, real big moves in there, but maybe touch on that a little bit before we wrap up the call.
Sure. Well, the Fed continues to try to walk a fine line here. You know, on one hand, you've got, as John Portwood has talked about, you've got weakness outside of our borders. Europe is going the opposite direction. They're cutting interest rates. Japan is cutting interest rates. They're going more and more negative in terms of interest rates overseas, it seems like, monthly. So the Fed's looking at that, and they saw a lot of the disruption taking place in the emerging markets and in the credit markets. So the Fed kind of got cold feet. They met in mid-March, and they basically revised their outlook. Every meeting they poll all the Fed participants and the Fed governors, and they say, where do you think rates are going to be at the end of 2016, at the end of 2017? And so everybody just anonymously puts their bet. They call it the dot plot. And there was a dramatic change. Back in December when they reported this, it was anticipated there'd be four increases. They anticipated there would be four increases in 2016. They met in March, and they revised that down to two. Of course, the market's been way ahead of them. The market currently thinks there's maybe one increase this year. So at least they're kind of getting in the same ballpark as the rest of the investment world. So the Fed is concerned. They're looking at, in their words, it's global economic developments pose risk to United States growth. So they're concerned about what's happened outside of our borders. But all that said, they still are likely to raise interest rates at least once this year, continue to tweak the interest rate markets a little bit, just to give them some alternatives if the economy does get soft, they can cut rates. That's probably their biggest concern, is that they really don't have a whole lot in the way of bullets to help juice the economy or generate growth if the economy did turn soft. So at this point, the Fed is cautious, but it seems determined to raise rates at least once this year.
All right. Any comments on interest rates longer term?
Well, it doesn't appear like there's a whole lot of impetus to push rates dramatically higher. There's been some pockets of inflation here and there, nothing that seems to be pervasive. As you mentioned, rates during the month of March started and ended in about the same spot during the month. They did go up pretty about a quarter of a percentage point on the 10-year until the Fed met and announced that they're becoming more dovish, and then rates turned right back around. Of course, now we're starting to see some weakness out of Europe, and that's going to again put pressure on rates to come down. So it's really just more sluggish growth around the world. It probably means that rates are at worst going to drift higher, but more than likely just sort of hang around this trading range where the 10-year has gone from maybe 1.65, 1.7% to up to 2.10 maybe, and then back down again. So just a trading range environment right now.
All right. Thank you, Jeff, and thank you, everyone, for joining us this morning. Please join us next month. Our call next month will be on Tuesday, May 3rd. Thank you.